Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey, you guys.
How are ya?
Happy day.
Happy day that ends in Y. Happy part 4 of 4 of a long and harrowing series.
I know. Can you believe we've made it?
Well, my computer sure can. Yes. It's running slow as fuck.
All the tabs have been open. We are finally getting to close them. There's something so satisfying.
Oh, yeah.
Like when you were in college and you were writing a research paper and you had every single bibliography open, you had to go in all the sources, and then you had to go to whatever the website was for it to put it in APA format for you. And even then that didn't work, and it was a whole thing. Anyway, after you submitted that paper, deleting them all was...
Yeah.
It was like a cigarette.
I feel, you know what?
As Abby would say.
As us two non-smokers sit here and talk.
Abby and I have never smoked, but...
No, never touched it. I know the second I do, I'd never put it down, which is why I cannot pick it up. But I am in the market for a prop cigarette, if anybody knows of where I can get one, because I need it for the bit.
Okay, well, Santa was working on that for you.
All right, well, tell the elves that I don't really want lung cancer, but I do really want a prop cig.
Yeah, Santa's working on it. The little minions are working hard.
I just feel like these days, like, everything is on fire a little bit. And so anytime I hear another update, you know that... I don't know if you know this. There's like a meme that comes out almost every year around Thanksgiving of a guy who's outside just like smoking a cigarette with his head back, and it like looks like he just sighed.
And yeah, it's like, that's what's his name?
Yes. Yes.
Shit. What's it? Ben Affleck.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
what's his name? You know the guy.
You know the guy. The Affleck guy.
Yeah. Ben Affleck. Yeah. He looks like he looks like he walked out of a bar and like the Patriots lost. That's what he looks like.
Yes. And that's what it feels like.
As a Bostonian himself.
He gets it.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like every time I learn anything these days. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, you know what? I could use a cigarette for the bit, because it would better describe how I feel than anything else.
It's true.
Speaking of which, because in the words of Smash Mouth, the world's on fire. We are going to take a slight break. We are going to take a couple weeks off. We're going to see you guys on Halloween. But can you believe it has been 3 years and we've never skipped 1 week?
This is the first time ever that we have taken a little bit of time. So yes. We are going to come back better than ever.
Yes.
Refreshed. We're just resetting. We're researching. We are going to be very present on Instagram. So you will not miss us. Yeah. We will be there. But we're not going to be putting out episodes until the end of October. So if you're not following the podcast wherever you're listening, please do, so that the day that we do post it, yes, and come back, that you're going to get notified.
And not to be one of those YouTubers, but like, ring the bell, you know, get notifications. Yeah. You'll get it. It should be just about Halloween. We don't want to skip out spoopy season entirely, but it is definitely some well-needed time with everything going on to choose to get a little break from the added on horrors that we research every week and tell you guys about. It's just nice because you guys get like an hour or two of content for like 15 to 20 hours of back end work on our hand, which we're not complaining about because we do love it. It just does add up.
It does. And we're going to take this break so that we do not burn ourselves out.
Yeah.
And because we like hanging out with you so much. We're going to be back. We're going to get through the holidays together. We're going to get through the dread of winter. We're just going to take a few weeks to recharge. You should too.
Yeah.
And come hang out with us on Instagram, because you know we're going to be going.
And if you're not ready for a break, girl, we got almost 200 episodes for you to binge.
Oh, we have so many episodes for you to tune into.
So many.
And I've timed this great because I've gotten a cold and yes, you can hear it in my voice. So this is awesome.
And I've timed it great because I'm on Prozac. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm just ready for a nap. Like, I feel like I've hit the midwinter slump, like, now.
I know, it's weird.
And so I'm really excited. I'm hoping this is a nice little preventative measure for the big sad. Enjoy the fall in New England.
It is.
Yeah.
Definitely is.
We get to see peep the little leaves, and we get to go to all the fairs. And it's just about like fair season. So I'm excited for that.
Make sure you get apple cider and go to a little pumpkin patch and do all the fun things. And again, you guys are going to blink. We'll be back. And We love you.
We love you so much. And thank you for being patient with us as we people a little bit outside of the pod and then we return.
Heck yeah.
But
what do you say we get into part four?
Let's do it. So, yoo-hoo, pod's on. Last one for part four of four in our Dean Coral series.
Hi, hello, and welcome, or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
Oh.
Thank you guys for joining us in our little corner of the true crime world, and again for tuning in to our fourth and final part covering Dean Coral, the Candyman. If you have not listened to parts 1 through 3, pause here, do that, and come back. Good job.
Hi.
You have spent the last few weeks learning about Dean Coral, his early life, his grooming of David Brooks, his initial crimes, David's compliance, and then meeting Wayne and his compliance in the unspeakable heinous acts committed against trusting innocent children and young adults. We left you last episode with where we began, Dean's death. But if you think that's where Dean's story ends, you are mistaken. Today, we're going to tell you about the aftermath of Dean's death. We're going to talk about the discovery of the mass graves, several of them, what happened to David and Wayne, and the theories of greater networks at play.
Dun, 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 dun.
So when Wayne was kind of convinced by Timothy to call the police and first responders arrived, they found something really weird. So the first guy shows up and he's like, okay, there's this dead naked man like in the hallway. And when he goes further into the bedroom, he finds plastic sheeting. He finds the torture board. He finds various sex toys. He finds ligatures. He finds handcuffs. It's very odd.
An industrial amount of lube.
Just wild. Horrendous. You've never seen so much lube.
Yeah. It's like a slip and slide in there. It is.
And while two teens, Rhonda and Timothy, were shaken and upset and kind of comforting each other, Wayne has like this 1,000-yard stare.
Yeah.
And he tells them that he killed Dean in self-defense.
Yeah.
But then he also kind of like word vomits everything.
Mm-hmm.
And at first they didn't believe him.
No.
And we talked about that last week. Like, why would you? I mean, of course, like the 30 missing kids locally should have clued you off, but like Wayne, like kids tell stories.
Yeah.
How believable is it that somebody's, oh, we've been killing children for 3 years?
Yeah.
Like that wasn't on that guy's bingo card. He was like, nobody thought that was happening. So at first they kind of dismissed him, and Wayne, in an attempt to like convince them, was like, I will bring you there.
Yes.
So Wayne led investigators to several of the dump sites, but he started with the boat shed. There, they found remains in various stages of decomposition. The infamous phone call from Wayne to his mother took place there. The infamous photos of Wayne sitting on a beach were from this time.
Yeah.
This is really where you see this case kind of pick up with the documentation of it, kind of the discovery of it. Like, there's very few pictures of Wayne and David that you see prior to this. There are a lot that you see after.
Yes, and I feel like there's about a billion of them on these first initial discovery days of showing investigators the different dump sites.
Yes. As you'll remember from last episode, David and Wayne had begun distancing themselves from Dean prior to Dean's death. Wayne tried to get a different job, join the military, move away, but he claimed that because of a threat from Dean, he was forced to return back. David was not involved in the last 5 murders. I don't think people realize this.
Yeah.
But he had really tried to get away. He was not associating by this point. His girlfriend, Bridget, had become pregnant. They got engaged. They apparently got married. He moved out of the Heights. So he didn't know the final murders happened. He was only looped into it all when Wayne confessed his and David's part in the murders.
Right.
So David likely thought he got away with it.
Probably.
Or that he was moving on with his life. Like, he was trying to run away, start his family. And then all of a sudden, like these months later, he's pulled in and it's like Wayne has kind of like tilted his cards.
Yeah. And always thought it was really interesting too, because we talk about the sort of strenuous relationship between David and his dad, that he went into the police station to give his statement with his dad, like his dad brought him in, which I thought was really interesting.
Wayne, though, because David wasn't, Wayne was the active member kind of during these last few. He kind of took the lead on this. Like he was at Dean's direction. He was following what Dean wanted.
Right.
But he had kind of taken that initial role that David had played. Yeah. Where, like, it was just kind of the pair of them. David had fucked off by now. Now it's just Wayne. And then he pissed Dean off that fateful day in August because he brought a girl to Dean's house.
Yeah, and it was like a no girls allowed club.
Apparently. And this was a decision that Wayne made that Dean thought he should be killed over.
Which is wild. And just the sheer amount of thin ice that he was walking on that whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Dean had started to kind of panic, so maybe he was just trying to rid the witnesses anyway.
Yeah.
And this was a really good way to see, like, you did it, Wayne. See, this is why I have to do this. And maybe he was planning it anyway. We don't know. We can't ask him. But apparently bringing Rhonda there was the reason that they all had to die in Dean's eyes.
Yeah.
So the investigators are pulling out these bodies, and remember that not every parent was searching for their kids.
Yeah.
Of the parents that were searching for their children, there are fewer than you would think. Those who were looking for their kids grew desperate. I mean, their sons vanished and the family was told that they must have run away. But a lot of these families knew that this wasn't the case. David Hillegeist's family literally hired a private investigator to work the case because they didn't feel like they were being taken seriously by law enforcement. And of course, this PI could not have solved it, but the PI did think that their son was used as an escort. And remember, we talked about the family traveled to a different area to go search for him. Like, they traveled out to, like, a sex club kind of thing, thinking that they might see their son. And that family grew so desperate that they spent every cent that they had on psychics, on the PI, on just anybody to try to help them. Like, they were so desperate, but just so scared and so willing to do anything. Like, they were at the end of their rope to just bring their baby home.
I think what breaks my heart so much about the Hillegeists too was that they get to a point where they're spending all their money on PIs, on these psychics, on trips to try to find their child, and it gets to a point they have to take down the missing flyers because they can't offer the reward anymore.
And it ended up getting so bad that even when they ran out of money, like, the PI felt so invested in David's case by this point that he continued to work it for free.
Yeah.
But because he knew that the family had, like, basically been bled dry.
Yeah.
And then the psychics were telling them all of these different things. It was like one told them that David was working in an oil field, so don't worry. And then another one said he was kidnapped, but he was in San Antonio. Essentially, those people just took advantage of chronically stressed, grieving, worried families seeking their missing children and just continued to bleed them dry.
Yeah.
And so the PI continued to work it until, with some pushback from the police, his PI license was taken away.
Yeah.
Mally Winkle's family received a call from him the night that he went missing where he told them he was going to a beach in Freeport with friends. What they didn't know at the time was that their son was forced by Dean to make that call, and when he didn't return home, they went and searched the beach that he told them he was at, which he was never at, and they searched that surrounding area rather than their own neighborhood where their son's body had already been buried.
Yeah.
So Dean had crafted these sort of tales to point people in the wrong direction, and they kind of run there, and it's too late because it was always too late. So we have a lot of moving parts. We have families that didn't seem to care. We had families that seemed to believe that their sons had taken jobs and moved. So it wasn't that they didn't care that their sons were gone. They just believed the reason they were told. And then we have the families desperately searching for answers. unknowingly searching in the wrong places. And these are just singular examples of the torments that almost all of these families went through in one way or another. And David and Wayne's leading the police to the victims also clued investigators into murders that neither boy was a part of.
Yeah.
For example, they found the body of Jeffrey Conan. Jeffrey was 18 years old, he was a college freshman, and he disappeared while hitchhiking in July of 1970. He and his friend were going from the University of Texas to Jeffrey's parents' house,
mm-hmm.
and they made it to Houston, and that's where the boys kind of split up. So I don't know if the friend was going there. I think they were kind of like all going to Houston, and then he went to go home. In all likelihood, he accepted a ride.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey was never seen again. The area in which they were last together was near one of the apartments that Dean had rented.
Right.
So it was like they were dropped off in his hunting ground. His body was found wrapped in plastic, naked with a gag in his mouth, hands and feet bound with nylon cord, and he had also been covered in a layer of lime to speed up the decomposition process. So David and Wayne did not know about this, but this body was already there by the time they started assisting in the disposals.
Right.
One of the fathers of one of the victims had an especially terrible realization. He was the one who had received a letter from his son who said he'd gone away for work and he would be back next year.
Yeah.
But his dad believed it. And again, many of these kids wrote letters, and I didn't see the specific name of this, but this was included in the book, The Man with the Candy. But when his dad got that letter, he believed it.
Right.
And he might have even been happy for him. So he didn't search for him because he didn't see a reason to. He knew where he was. Even with all the other boys going missing, he did not think there was a connection. He was only notified by investigators that his son's body had been recovered in a mass grave. And he said, no, that's wrong. My son's working. He'll be home next year.
Right. And that's just devastating.
It's, the tragedies just feel endless.
And on top of that, not all of the families received this kind of notification anyway. But some of them, certainly not as early as those that were originally identified. Some took years, and there are still one or two that are unknown. And more that are suspected that we can't officially connect back. But the one victim that we know is still unknown is identified currently as John Houston Doe or Swimsuit Boy. If you guys go through our sources, one of the last ones is from missingkids.org. And this actually has like a very interesting, I'm assuming like an AI or a CGI sort of compository sketch of what this young man would have looked like and the clothing that he was wearing to sort of describe it and see if anyone can identify him.
How awful.
It's awful. And I wish I could tell you his age. Like, I think they said something like between 15 and 20, if I'm remembering right, which
is his victim type.
His victim type and a pretty large age range when it comes to looking for young men.
Mm-hmm.
But his age is unknown, so is his name, and so is his story. And so that is one that I know people are really trying to see and get word out, because at this point, and it's morbid to say, but we're running out of time for people who can help identify. And so if you can, please take a look. But the initial investigation uncovered 27 boys, with 17 being found in the boat shed, 6 at High Island Beach, and 4 at Lake Sam Rayburn. That first week, about 21 of the 27 bodies were identified, which left 6 still unknown. And that's 6 sets of parents that are searching for their babies. 6 different families, friends, and communities with their loved ones vanished. And this is where we get into something fascinating in this case that I'm sure we'll see in others one day, but I had never heard of until I watched that documentary or like docuseries called The Clown and the Candyman. And this talks about forensic anthropologists. And I want to apologize because I'm pretty sure last week I said forensic archaeologists, which are different things, and I know that. But my brain is scrambled eggs. Okay, give me a break.
We have the brain scramblies. Please forgive us.
Thank you. At least I'm not yelling at a microwave, you know?
If you know, you know. watch What We Do in the Shadows.
That being said, to give the very pertinent credit where it is due, it was at the hard work, science, and sheer determination of the forensic anthropologists that worked this case in which the next victim's identities came to light. If you're interested in a more in-depth review of this, try checking out the book, The Scientist and the Serial Killer, The Search for Houston's Lost Boys by, I think it's Lisa Olson, but it's Lisa, L-I-S-E. This goes over the years of work scientists and anthropologists did together in order to identify the outstanding victims and even corrected at least one incorrect identification that was originally made. And this was led primarily by Dr. Sharon Derrick with the help of other scientists and a lot of DNA. They were able to identify five of these six unidentified bodies.
Which is incredible.
Which puts us at 26 identified of the 27 and has left Swimsuit Boy. Or John Houston Doe, unknown. It's also important to talk about how these scientists believe there were other victims. Of course, Allie and I talked about assuming there were more because this is just what was confirmed, truly. Once again, we only know the victims that were found at the burial sites that David and Wayne knew about. And of those, we only know about the details of the ones that David and Wayne knew and helped with. But there were others that were found, and there were even more potential victims that forensic anthropologists found. I think there were two different kinds of bones that were not connected to any of the identified victims or of the 27 bodies that they found. So that suggests at least 29. If we're assuming, and I'm assuming because there's 27, 29 doesn't seem like a big jump. Especially because Dean was really working at covering some of this. He's working with the lie to sort of cover the stench and start the decomposition going faster. I wouldn't be surprised. And that's just where we knew where to look. But even on top of that, there were 42 boys that went missing in the Heights alone between 1970 and 1973. The idea that Dean Corll started with both horrendous, sadistic torture, rape, and murder without escalating from other crimes first is really unlikely. The chances of there being many, many more victims, whether they were murder victims, rape victims, torture victims, or a combination of all of those, is significantly higher.
I also think in this, I know we'll get to a Gacy connection later.
Yeah.
But this feels very reminiscent to me, and this is just my, like, pure conjecture. But with Gacy, he got off on abusing and torturing his victims, but he only realized he liked killing them when he accidentally did.
Right.
Like, his goal wasn't to kill them. And then when he did accidentally kill one, he realized, oh, that's the best part.
Just kidding. Now that's what I want to do.
And then that became part of his routine where that he wouldn't part with.
Right.
So it makes me wonder if, because there's so many similarities in sort of the way that their brains worked and the way that they operated and, like, gathered victims and were believably, like, this nice guy on the outside.
Yeah.
It just makes me wonder if there's that similarity in common too, because I do not think that Dean started with David.
No.
It's possible, but I just don't think so. I don't even know that he was not doing naughty things in Indiana when he went to go visit. So when Wayne is brought into this, Dean's like 30 years old.
Right.
So Wayne's 15, Dean's 31, and she's twice his age.
Yeah.
Imagine how much less suspicious it would be for Dean to be 25. Right. And doing that, or 23 and doing that. Like, the closer to his victim's age range, the less odd it would be to see them hanging out.
Yeah.
So did that give him more access? Did he do anything when he was in Indiana with his grandmother on the farm? Like, I have a lot of questions. I don't have answers to them, but I don't know what I think. I just don't think we know it all.
Well, and also, I think it's interesting to assume that these two boys, or young men at this point, knew all of the burial sites. When they too were victims. Like, there were people before them. I'm almost positive. But there are also many other locations. Like you said, Indiana, when Dean went into the forces for a little bit when he was drafted, I'm sure there was ample opportunity in other places he has been that in the 3 years he knew David and Wayne, he didn't take them to those places for them to show investigators.
We also don't know if these are the only accomplices.
Right.
We know that Dean was going to kill Wayne.
Yep.
There were rumors that there was a rift between Dean and David.
Yeah.
At least according to Betty Hawkins, who was Dean's girlfriend that we'll talk about here in a minute. But, you know, she would tell you that Dean was afraid of David.
Yeah.
So was David saying, was Dean being like, oh, I'm afraid of him, so if you don't see him anymore, that's why?
Yeah.
And killing him? You know what I mean? Like, there are just certain things you can think that we don't know how many. There could be victims that haven't been discovered yet that could have also been an accomplice before.
Right. David and Wayne 1.0, almost. Yeah. Like, and we just don't know, but obviously he wasn't making that separation between victim and accomplice in a lot of ways. And that, again, it's just from what we know, and I hate that we don't know more, but with all of this coming to light after Dean's death, and the only other storytellers we have being these teenagers that it sounds like, I mean, I'll be honest, I think they've said everything they knew about, but they were only teenagers, and this was a full-grown man with twice the amount of life behind him.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that they'd know everything or that they'd remember everything is crazy.
And
so,
also trauma in the brain.
Oh, yeah. We've like been through that.
We're like relying on that, too. So I think there's a lot. There's so many different aspects of this that make us think that we do not know everything.
Yeah. And ultimately, with the number of these initial victims, or I'll say like firsthand victims unknown, the number of secondary is so much higher. It's got to be exponentially higher, like unimaginably out of reach. The people, the families, the communities that he has victimized from his crimes.
Oh, absolutely. And we said Dean really didn't keep adult relationships, but the two adult people that he was in contact with would have been a girlfriend and his mother.
Right.
And after Dean's death, of course, both were devastated. But as soon as he was dead, the reason he was dead came out.
Yeah.
And they had some other theories as to what was going on. So Betty Hawkins was Dean's girlfriend for 5 years.
It's a lot of years.
Notice how we have really not spoken about her.
Mm-hmm.
Neither did Dean.
Yeah.
This relationship clearly meant so much more to her than it ever did to him. They were on again, off again. She wanted to get married. He always kind of had an excuse.
Well, she wasn't exactly his type.
Not quite. Well, she was alive, so that right off the bat.
She, yep. Alive, uh-huh. Adult. That's really, it's three strikes and she's out, unfortunately.
Pretty much. That's just baseball, you know what I mean? And when she would recall her relationship with Dean, she was like, I don't believe any of this could be true about him because he was always so nice and he was respectful. And what she really liked about him was that he never tried to make her do anything sexually that she didn't want to do. And she found this admirable.
Sure.
I find it, he was yucking her yum. You know what I mean? He's not into it.
Yeah, and I think it's a weird fine line because, yay, he's not forcing you into sexual acts, but he is forcing someone into sexual acts. You just don't know that.
Correct.
And it's less so the desire to be respectful and kind of your consent and, I don't know, desires than it is about who you are.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, this, I didn't see this referenced anywhere, so this is just me
conjecture,
making assumptions. But we're in the South.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of religious influence.
Uh-huh.
I might argue that maybe she found him all the more admirable that he didn't want to have sex with her. Maybe she thought saving for marriage or something, like,
mm-hmm.
that there, not that you have to be religious for that principle to kind of guide you, but maybe she just found it refreshing that he was a guy that she dated that wasn't after one thing and one thing only.
Right.
But then I think about 5 years in, and she said that there was only ever one time where he like made a move.
Oh.
And then they stopped before anything really happened, and he was like, oh, actually, yeah. No. And so I'm sure at that point she's wondering why.
I would be. And like you said, you don't have to be religious for that to be a goal of yours, to like save it for something special or a special connection. But just culturally speaking, that was something that was widely seen. And also, and this is absolutely not at all a dig at her in any way, and I want to make that very clear. If it is so religious that that is sort of the cultural norm, that you're waiting for those things based on religious principle only, it's also probably a good chunk of why he didn't want to be out of the closet.
Mm-hmm.
So she was probably a mighty fine closet door, if you will.
Well, right. And the other, so we'll talk more about her, but of course she denies knowing anything.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I believe that. She knew so little about him, clearly, that I don't think that she was keeping his secrets for him, but I think she was entirely blindsided and disgusted with what happened. But she stood by him. He wasn't alive, but she defended kind of his memory for years until I think she kind of woke up. But she was claiming that the story that the police were kind of pushing must have been wrong, you know, that he wouldn't have done that. And they must have been blaming him because he was dead. The other two are alive. He's not. And so he's the easy fall guy for this.
Right.
And Betty, being a divorced mother of two boys herself, thought Dean's kindness to the teenagers in the neighborhood was admirable. Like, she found it sweet the way that he looked out for them. And so she thought he loved these kids. He wasn't going to hurt anybody, and they're just kind of pointing the finger at him. Homegirl is just not buying it. She's not taking the story. She's not down. She did also, as we referred to before, think that Dean was like afraid of David, or he made some kind of comment about like, if David comes and asks where I am, don't tell him. So like, she knew some rift was going on but didn't know exactly what it was. But again, she still defended him. Betty also said that Dean was moving to Colorado rather abruptly, that he had been making plans to get out of Texas, and she believed that this was to be to get away from David and Wayne, which kind of like furthered her point of being like, it wasn't him, it was them.
Got it.
But she continued to stand up for him in the public arena for years, and her denial was only rivaled by that of Dean's mother, Mary.
Well, denial isn't just a river in Egypt, you know?
Mary West did not believe her son could or would have done the horrific things he was accused of.
Yeah.
But really, what parent would say, you know what, actually, I could see it. you know, like, that's some outlandish shit that even if deep down she really did think that, there's no way you're going to get a woman to say that. I think it's also maybe a protective measure in our brains to shield us from harsh truth. Like, you know, we can kind of put up some pretty high walls, kind of fight it.
Cognitive dissonance is a hell of a drug, for sure.
But if she did know deep down he was guilty, maybe she was concerned about what would happen to her reputation. Her image would suffer if she admitted that and then was like, oh, you're the mother of this guy.
Yeah.
But if in her circles, remember, she's moved, she's out in Colorado, maybe if she sells it like he's falsely accused, I don't know. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I think there's some possibilities there, but she was not here for it.
It's also kind of ironic to me to think that she has maybe like genetically too much shielding and protecting of children, where Dean had none. Like, he almost overrides that mental block to hurt kids. And he's like, I don't care, I'm gonna. And she's like, no, you can't even tell me that a child did that. Like, I won't even hear it.
Well, and remember when she was still in charge of the candy company and he was kind of like a boss there, but she still owned it?
Yeah.
That one of the kids complained to her that Dean was sexually harassing him.
Yeah.
And instead of talking to her son or acknowledging that it might be her son really doing that, that she just fired the other kid instead. Yeah. So there is sort of like a... like there's crumbs of it along the way that she could have picked up on and probably did. I think that that denial of like accepting that your son is one of the most prolific sadistic serial killers in American history is a very hard pill to swallow.
For sure.
And it is so much easier to not do it.
Everybody, I think, would rather not have to process that.
Right. And so when she's talking about him, she's like, he was a good boy. He always listened, you know? And she couldn't accept that her... Mary could not accept that her son was gay.
Yeah.
Like, just point blank, she denied that too. And when news of the murders broke, she quickly contacted clairvoyants and card readers to get some kind of insight as to what was happening. One woman she called who was in Dallas claimed that there was no need to worry. Dean wasn't gay.
Yeah.
Based on the time and day that Dean was born, he couldn't possibly be gay.
Everybody knows if you're a Scorpio, you're gay. But if you're a Libra, it won't touch you.
Well, it's only the ones born in the morning. You know what right. I mean? It's the nighttime. You know, you got to be worried about the nighttime ones.
The AM Libras, totally fine. Correct. PM Libras, you got to watch. No, I'm kidding. And I'm not coming for you. Just, it's hysterical to think about it this way.
But the fact that there was this woman on the other end of the phone that's like, this is insane, but I'm going to make money from this. Yeah, so in looking at this, picture the woman like thumbing through a gossip magazine. Yeah. And she's like, let me check my references. Oh, yep, I'm looking at it right here. What time? What day?
Yep, you said 10:50 p.m.?
Couldn't
okay.
be him.
Yeah.
So anyway, just the fact that she was in such denial about what was a fact at that point. Yeah. Versus like, you know, Dean hadn't been convicted of anything, and initially Wayne and David weren't either, but like, of course you can't charge a dead man, but like,
right,
it wasn't official yet.
It's also one of those things that you see earlier too. One of her ex-husbands of the few was like, don't you think it's weird he keeps hanging around all those little boys? And she was like, no.
And then she divorced him because she divorced everybody. So yeah. She's got astrological evidence on her side, and she's got these like psychics telling her this.
Boat shed of 17 fucking people.
Yes. Babies, by the way.
At least.
Men from 13 to 20 years old.
So I don't know what the cards say that's about, but I'm going to put some stock in what they're saying.
Well, no, because there's another card reader in Colorado where she was.
Okay.
This one was in Colorado Springs. She told Mary that Dean wasn't responsible for the murders.
Oh.
His crime, now he was guilty, it was that he knew too much and he didn't speak up soon enough.
Okay.
So she's like, okay, this is his fault. You know, Mary hung her hat on this, and she refused to acknowledge the literal mountains of evidence that proved otherwise.
That he was too pensive about knowing of at least 27 murders.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, you know, curiosity killed the cat, I guess, but goodness.
Absolute madness. So that's Mary. And then let's move into the trials.
Yes.
Okay. We'll start with David. We started with David in part one. We'll start with David in part four. His trial lasted 1 week.
Yep.
Which is a pretty brief trial. Considering, I mean, think of how long the Karen Reed trial was.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
And then we have this. So just, you know, food for thought. In this trial, his defense tried to limit his culpability by saying that he was a child at the time, and he was,
mm-hmm.
and that he never killed anybody, which is true. He never took a life. But he watched it, aided in it, concealed it, and didn't report it.
Mm-hmm.
And the prosecution said just that. You know, he might not have been the one to end the life, but he was complicit in so many lives ending.
Yeah.
Jury deliberation lasted only 90 minutes before he was found guilty and was given a life sentence.
Yeah.
He didn't show any emotion when the verdict was read, but the same could not be said for his wife, who became so emotional that she had to leave the courtroom.
Yeah.
David denied interviews in the future, though he did actually assist with identifying victims in the early 2000s. David kind of remained the way he was as a kid forever. And what I mean by that is that he was very passive. He was very quiet. He was very shy. He didn't say much at 12. He didn't say much in his teens during the murders. He didn't say much after he was arrested, and he didn't say much when he was in jail.
Yeah.
Like, the man really just kept everything in. So we know so little about his experience because he really didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Versus Wayne is an entirely different story. They're kind of opposite in that way. But David is just largely, like, non-actionable. He just didn't do much. He would be prodded in a direction and he would go. Like, he'd be corralled to do things. But independent thinking did not seem like that was his strong suit.
Yeah.
And from what I see.
No, agreed. And I think it's a little bit frustrating to be like, there's so much here that you definitely know because you definitely saw it and helped in so much. And yet you refuse to stop it, but you'll help identify victims, but you won't help people sort of process this and try to figure out what actually happened.
Yeah. And I mean, granted, he was also 12 when this started.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, the better part of his life was spent with Dean than without him.
Right.
You know, like the impact that he had, he's like 18 years old when this goes, like he's got 6 of the formative years. You don't really remember much of the first few years. So if from 12 to 18, you're with this man, that feels like your whole life.
Yeah. It's definitely over half, you know?
Now, his wife, Bridget, who he married again before he was arrested and everything, initially, I think she tried to stand by him, but it became too much. She divorced him in 1977.
Yeah.
But they did have that daughter. So remember, he's arrested in August of 73. The baby is born in December of 73.
Yeah.
So while like the bodies are being dug out of all of these places, this woman is pregnant. And she gave birth to their daughter that they named Rachel Lynn Brooks.
Yeah.
Rachel maintained contact with her dad over the years, and she actually went to visit him in prison regularly.
Yeah.
Rachel, though, tragically died in a car accident at 18 years old on the evening of her prom. David's one and only child died older than many of the victims he, Wayne, and Dean took.
Yeah.
But he still lost a child. David Brooks was 65 years old when he died on May 28th, 2020. On May 12th, David was brought to a hospital in Galveston to be treated for COVID-19. Reports state he suffered from many other health complications prior to this, but COVID is ultimately what is listed on his death certificate. It's ultimately what they claim he died of.
Right.
David corresponded with Wayne one time while they were in prison. This was via letter. They both agreed to stay in touch and then neither followed through. And Wayne said something later to the effect of, what was the point? So they could both just say how they wish they'd never met Dean.
Yeah.
Like, what did they have to talk about? But Wayne did confirm, like,
for what?
I sent a letter. He responded. He even said, he's like, he typed it and he didn't even sign it.
Yeah.
Like, he found that odd and they were like, we should stay in touch. And then neither stayed in touch. But it's like, you're kind of linked only by these tragedies and horrific evil that you committed. What is there to talk about?
Yeah, and I honestly, I kind of have mixed feelings on that. On one hand, I do think it's kind of rare to see people so trauma bonded just drop each other like that. Because what I mean, as much horror as they did, and they did a lot of horror, they also definitely were living in their own horror film. So like, it is fascinating to me that they would have sort of a common enemy,
mm-hmm,
and that trauma bond and still drop it. But at the same time, I kind of agree.
But they also weren't friends. It wasn't right. Like, it wasn't like their shared experience with Dean brought them closer. I think they were both on edge around each other. Remember,
yeah,
Wayne is pretty sure he was brought to Dean by David to be a victim.
Right.
So I don't know if you ever build that trust.
That's a rough start to a friendship.
Yeah, that's like that's not great. I don't think you and I would be here right now if when we met you did that to me.
Oof. Yeah,
that's just not cool. You know? But I also think that when we see accomplices like stay in touch after, I think it's one of two things. I think they're married or they're family. So brothers like the Menendez brothers or like a couple. I mean, and then you also see the animosity between couples too. Like I think of Myra Hindley and Ian. Oh, I forget his last name. But like they were so in love, us against the world, sort of like we'll burn it down, but at least we'll be together.
Yeah.
To like hating each other. And like there is that fine line between love and hate. And for a lot of people, it is so very fine.
Yes.
But I think when we look at accomplices, it's so rare for it to be this like tertiary relationship where like they each had a relationship with Dean, but the one between each other was kind of not.
Yeah, it was not it was a great weird love triangle that wasn't completed. But I also am thinking, too, when I think of accomplices or people that sort of knew each other in connections outside who stay in touch, there's also sometimes that thread of like wanting to either relive the glory days or like make plans for the future if they ever get out.
Mm-hmm.
And because this was so horrible for both of them in their own ways, that is a very interesting piece that I've personally, like in reading all of this and saying any of it, I wasn't really concerned about. I wasn't like, oh, if they get out, they'll do this exact thing again. Because this is terrifying. Like, this is awful. And if you're planning to redo or continue what you were doing, they're saying, yeah, let's go back to that.
Yeah, I don't think they're reliving the glory days and wanting to go over every detail to get off on it again. I really don't. Like, I think they are where they belong to be. I think prison is the spot for them. But I don't think if they were to be let out today, well, David's let out. No. But I think if Wayne were to be let out of prison right now, I don't think he would do it again.
No.
But I don't think that earns you your freedom.
Exactly.
But you know what I mean? Like, so it isn't that these were the masterminds and they got caught. The mastermind's already dead.
Right. And they're just kind of living in, well, if it ain't the consequences of their actions, and also, well, if it ain't the PTSD.
Of the consequences of our actions.
Yeah. And so as far as Wayne's trial went, he obviously participated more actively in these vile attacks, so he rightfully got more time. Unlike David, Wayne is still alive and in prison today. Elmer Wayne Henley Jr. was on trial for over 2 weeks, with over 25 witnesses for the prosecution and none for defense. At the time, Texas actually didn't have the death penalty, which kind of shocked me, but he was not up for the death penalty. And at the end of the trial, the prosecutor actually apologized for not being able to seek this out. He called Wayne a monster who should be removed from society.
Well,
Wayne's attorneys merely highlighted that Wayne was why Dean was dead and also why the killing stopped altogether. And they also highlighted that Wayne was why so many victims were able to be recovered at all. For the 6 counts of murder that he faced, Wayne got 6 99-year sentences or life sentences to run consecutively, so one after another, which would have totaled in 594 years.
That checks out.
However, because he has his whole life to spend wasting time and money behind bars, he did appeal. It's a right for everyone. I don't besmirch him that, but anybody who's got the time will use the time. So he sure did.
Endless appeals.
Yep. And shockingly, his appeal was actually granted on the terms that he was denied an evidentiary trial and that the jury was not separated, I assume for like certain parts of evidence and testimony. But Henley was tried again. He was again found guilty of 6 murders, but he did get a better bargain this time because even though he was still sentenced to 6 99-year terms, he was now able to serve them concurrently or at the same time. So 99 versus 594, it's a pretty good bargain, I guess. He is eligible for parole, but has never been approved, and he will be up for parole again next in October of 2025 at the ripe old age of 69. Noise. You know? But Wayne has had a life behind bars, even more than freed from them. Wayne reportedly worked prison jobs most of his time incarcerated into middle age. He says that he tries to keep busy and not to dream too much of the old days.
Yeah, I'm sure they are pretty bad, so that's good.
Yeah, and it also makes sense that he was diagnosed with PTSD and night terrors come with that shit. So he's shown symptoms of that since incarceration, even though he wasn't diagnosed until a little bit into it, it sounds like.
Right, and it was the 70s. Like,
yeah, yeah.
We didn't have all the words yet.
No, we were just barely starting to see the effects on people coming back from Vietnam.
Yep.
Yeah. But Wayne also has taken to various artistic endeavors to pass the time, including painting and making jewelry.
So you can purchase some of his creations.
Insert chain smoking here. Yeah, you sure can.
You can contribute to his commissary money. Can you believe that?
What's interesting, he did for a while, I don't know if he still does, donate a lot of the proceeds to victims' families or a charity of sorts for them. You can look up his art. I will give you a few heads up. The first is that I have not seen any of his jewelry, so don't come at me if that's great. I don't know. But the drawing and painting is a very interesting dichotomy to me. He's colorblind, so he can't see the difference in red and green, which is why he claims, I don't really think it has anything to do with it, but he claims that's why he only ever does portraits of people in black and white versus landscapes he'll do in full color, which is interesting. He does not do anything that's violent or explicit in nature, but he does have a few of like sexy little girls that he's drawn that I'm kind of like, I mean, they probably don't give you Playboy in prison, so I guess you're drawing it, but it's weird that I can see it, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's weird that I can see it and that next to it is like a painting of a sand dune.
Yeah. You know? Just odd.
So not anything really noteworthy, but definitely weird. You can see it.
You know there's a market for that.
Oh, yeah. Yes, there is.
Oh.
And I did see, okay, I did see a Reddit post that had some of it in there. And there's like one gallery screenshot that's a few places. Like you can see a bunch of his works in teeny tiny squares. And one of them does have a woman with her leg up. Like she's kind of laying down and one leg is up. And there was a Reddit comment that has not left my brain. And it was like, sorry, you're going to read this, but looks like she about to shart real bad. Can't stop picturing it because I know it was supposed to be like a seductive little piece that he drew and I'm like, oh.
And you know Wayne's like, damn it.
I know. But Wayne has offered interviews to sources before, but none quite as in-depth or open as the interview that was recently given for both the book and subsequent documentary sort of docu-series. I think it was just one part though.
Yeah, just one part.
Called The Serial Killer's Apprentice, which brings us to our thoughts on said interview.
Yes, so we promised you we'd talk about the interview. We both watched it separately.
Yes.
I have to say I was a little disappointed.
Yeah.
I was under the impression that it would be really more like conversational.
Like a sit-down interview.
Yeah, like I was kind of hoping, like when you hear like the Bundy tapes, for example, mm-hmm. like there's one or two people asking questions, there's Bundy responding and kind of going back and forth. And in this, these are very like edited responses. You don't actually see him. He's not across the glass. There's some moments that are like obviously made for dramatic effect with the doctor. She's like, I can help with that. And it, you know, it just kind of takes away from the very seriousness of it. I do appreciate that they had people that grew up in the Heights that were there at the time that knew some of the victims that knew Wayne from when he was a kid. And there's some footage that like I've never seen before of his mother and of Wayne and just kind of like seeing how he interacted and like just kind of his posture, like he's a very thin, kind of tall boy. He's shoulder slumped over, hair long, covering his face. Like, the the shame he feels and the lack of confidence, I think, is pretty clear to see.
Palpable, for sure.
But those eyes, man, like, and the sad thing is, and it's not that it matters at all, but I think Dean was a good looking guy. I think David was pretty average good looking. Mm-hmm. I think Wayne is a handsome kid. Like, he was a handsome kid.
Yeah.
That, like, you expect people to be that are capable of that to be ghoulish.
Yeah.
And they look like somebody that you wouldn't have been creeped out by.
Right.
Dean wouldn't have given you the heebie-jeebies, probably. Wayne, kind of, like, his eyes, like, I feel like if he were killing somebody, he'd be terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
But I could also see, like, if he was charismatic, that boyish charm could get you. Right. Like, he always wanted to be helpful. That's what everybody kind of said when they talk about him growing up, is, like, he was very sweet. And I would say it's kind of lackluster for new information, because going into this, I knew a lot of what he shared.
Right.
But there are some things revealed here that I thought were interesting.
I did think it was interesting that he sort of brought up more of this threat of the syndicate that Dean had, that he was like, that was a larger looming threat than most sources sort of make it out to be. It's also really interesting that the only context, conjecture he could add to his first meeting with Dean was that he told him someone knew where he was.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
He said he was talking about it. And of course they have, like, the reenactment.
Yeah.
They have the reenactment in the back, so you don't really know how it played, or of course they're dramatizing it, but that David brought Wayne to Dean, and Dean, like, had a knife out, and it kind of, like, freaked him out. And then David kind of came in the room abruptly and was like, "Does anybody know that you're here?"
Yeah.
And Wayne was just said that, like, he felt like he needed to say yes, so he did. But I don't think anybody did know he was there.
Yeah, but he did make it sound like he made that up.
Yeah, he was like, "My mom knows that I'm here." And so they were kind of like, "Oh, shit." And so Wayne kind of talked about, he was like, in that moment, like, he goes, I go back to that a lot because a couple things scare me. One was I going to be a victim?
Right.
Like, he doesn't know for sure. I think so, obviously.
Well, yeah.
But he, I don't think, ever got it confirmed from them. But he also kind of said that, like, he felt like he needed to say that someone knew where he was. But then when Dean kind of accepted him, he was like, did he accept me and use me because he saw a psychopath in me?
Right.
Like, did he, as a psychopath, recognize that I was one? And I think Wayne, like, struggled with that in his adult years of, like, who am I? What? Because these formative years were kind of, like,
yeah,
stolen and shaped all wrong.
To say the least. Yeah, and I do think that is interesting, and it was something that I hadn't really considered, of once you get to the other side of that, how do you process that as a person who was both a victim and an offender? Mm-hmm. Because I do believe in many ways he was both. I do think I don't know if I'm excited or I'm sad that it was lackluster. Like, in a lot of ways, I'm kind of like, well, thank God there wasn't this giant, huge story or conspiracy or big excuse of why the things. And I commend that he was like, for a minute I was stressed out and then didn't know what to do, but then I very much did know what to do and I did the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. I think that's honest.
But he's also had 50 years to craft a very remorseful sounding response to that, and he also knows that he's up for parole after this interview airs.
Right.
So, yeah, like, it seems almost pro him.
It was very interesting.
Or, like, pro empathy for him. And which is kind of hard to find when you're juxtaposing that with the bodies, like, the footage of the bodies being pulled out that he, like, these are kids that he killed. You know what I mean? Like,
right. And I do, part of me does wonder how much of that is for air, for show, because I am certain that there's at least a percentage of it that is. Mm-hmm. But I also, I do have a little bit of empathy for him. It doesn't mean I don't hold him responsible and culpable of all of these horrible things he did. It doesn't mean I think he should be out, but that was a kid. And it doesn't sound like, I mean, it's weird to hear him talk about his childhood. Like, he kind of idealizes it. His mom was like, hell no.
He remembers his childhood so differently.
Yes.
That was one of the things that I wanted to talk about, because his mom is interviewed and she, first of all, has his eyes, or he has her eyes. So they have these striking blue eyes. And she's very emotional. This is after everything. And she was like, he was such a good boy. He was a Boy Scout. Like, you know, she was like, he always wanted to help. He always protected us. And like, I think she, you could see the guilt like in her face, like, that she kind of let the reins like off of him, that like she put him in positions where he needed to
protect
and provide, and that she allowed that as the parent. And that's not to say that there aren't a million things at play there, but you can just kind of see it in her face that like she acknowledges what her son did, but she just doesn't believe where it came from. And when Wayne was asked about why he thought, not like just why he was chosen, but like why he thought he was able to do the things that he did knowing they were wrong, he said a couple of really interesting things that I want to talk about, because he said that Dean appealed to his hero complex.
Yeah.
Which I would not really call anything that he did abiding by that hero complex, but the way that he broke it down was like, you know, we talked about he had to defend his mom from his dad.
Yeah.
And now it's so fascinating because Wayne is like, I have great memories of my dad. I have great memories of my childhood. And his mom is like, it wasn't great. Like, it was really bad. Yeah. And like, you'd usually imagine it the opposite. Like, she would try to conceal what happened at the house and he would tell the truth.
Yeah, real Dean and Mary kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, he is like, I remember my dad walking me to school. I remember him being there. And Mary is just like, it was really bad. Like, he was abusive. He had to protect us from him.
Yeah.
But Wayne put so many of these abusive people on a pedestal.
Yeah.
In his mind, like, he really prioritized and valued the opinions of really not great men. And you see that with his dad. You see that with Dean, that he has these positive memories that no one else seems to have, and they remember what he went through and that it wasn't positive. But he also needed to be the one to save his mom and save his siblings.
Right. Well, and I know that we, when we talked about it a little bit, it just kind of sparked for me, like, realizing that he might not have had any other kind of man in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his dad was abusive, and then he meets Dean. So anybody who's not serially, sadistically torturing and murdering children probably doesn't seem that bad. And then every other man he knows is someone who's incarcerated with him or family. Yeah, and that's it. So I could understand like his spectrum being a little skewed there. Like, the population he's pulling from isn't the best of the best that we know of.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
It's a skewed population.
But it's also, it is interesting to sort of juxtapose that with wanting to be a hero of, like, I know that they're bad enough that someone needs protecting from you, and I want to be the one to do that, but I also don't want you not to like me. And I don't know how much of that latter is like self-preservation or like misplaced idolization.
Yeah. Or is it just like kind of any port in a storm? In other words, any man that is there that is setting an example, you want the approval from.
Right.
Even if that person isn't someone you should want to seek approval from.
Right.
But like, when they talk about his hero complex in the beginning, he apparently felt like he was saving these boys because they got to go to, you know, California and go live out on the ocean and be houseboys and, you know, like sex slavery is what it was. Yeah. But if what Wayne and David were experiencing were similar, where they got sexual acts performed on them and got paid,
that's a different life.
Then that's a very different life. And maybe there's a shred of truth in there where he really did think kids could be benefiting from that. So like, Wayne told him about the sex slavery, and he was like, yeah, that's where David Hillegeist is.
Yeah.
Like, he's up in California. And he was like, oh, no shit. Because he had been helping, like, he was friends with David, and he had been handing out the flyers for that family. And so he didn't know yet what happened to all of these people. But now he's like, oh, I can be part of this. Like, I can help. And I get Dean's approval, this other male who has kind of taken on that, like, authority role. And Wayne's like, yeah, he knew how to appeal to me. Like, he knew.
Yeah.
How to make me, like, make me feel like I had a purpose. And then afterwards, he would tell me he was proud of me.
Yeah. And that's the thing that has always kind of stuck with me, is even after everything, even after being an accomplice and aiding and abetting and physically helping hands-on with the torture and all of these murders, and then being equally scared for his own life that he's killed Dean, his first thought is he would be proud of me. And that, to me, spoke everything it needed to about just the grip that Dean had on him. That you could be scared enough to kill him, to know you need him dead or it's you, and that you're still seeking that validation.
Well, and I think that even goes further, because he's in this documentary, he's saying, like, Dean became an authority figure over me. And so by doing what he wanted me to do, it absolved me of my guilt.
Right.
Because he knew what he was doing was wrong. But because
someone higher than him told him to.
But because Dean wanted him to do it, and he was doing it for him.
Right.
That it negated the moral, like, damage that he was taking. You know what I mean? It was,
yeah,
it was still worth it. So it was like, it was a net positive.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, even in killing him, and even in that, like, feeling like he would still be proud, like, he is still trying to, like, that authority is still over him, where it's like, well, I am doing this, and this would make him proud of me, and I really need that.
Yeah.
That trumps any guilt I would feel about anything, because I still made him happy, you know?
Yeah, and I think it, I mean, man, I wish I had an ounce of the athletic talent of the mental gymnastics that these people do.
Oh, yeah, he's Simone Biles-ing that shit.
Literally.
Yeah.
Gold on.
Yeah.
Awful and fascinating how, like, I feel like he really figured out a way to do that mental acrobats to, like, feel okay with everything he did. And I think even now, trying to make sense of it, I have not seen anywhere that he has a released diagnostic list. I don't think he was a psychopath in the terms of, like, being diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. But I will say the one thing I did really like in this interview specifically, or this documentary, was that you got a better sense of how true the accounts of him as a kid were. Like, it really did feel like that wasn't amped up so that you'd have more empathy for him elsewhere. Like, other people really did think he was a good kid.
Yeah.
And then he got mixed up in Dean, and it went south so fast.
Well, it was that, it seemed like all of these things started to happen at the same time.
Right.
First, his parents got divorced. Mm-hmm. He struggled. Then he struggled in school. Yep. He had to repeat the 9th grade. He was then prescribed Valium. Whether he took it and had adverse responses to it, or whether he sold it and that began his drug dealing section of his life, or whatever, I don't think it helped him. I don't think it's the reason for all of his problems, but I think that these are the order of events. And then being so sort of disenchanted with school and having to redo it, and maybe making money from selling Valium. I don't know. I didn't see that referenced anywhere, but we do know as a child he sold drugs. That's access to one. So he quits school and gets a job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gets two jobs to support his family, that all of those protective factors have now vanished.
Right.
But you can kind of see, like, the order of events of him just getting, like, further and further away from, like, what would have helped him.
Yeah.
And then Dean tells David to find the kids addicted to drugs, find mm-hmm. the ones that are running away, find the homeless ones, and, like, the lost ones, the ones no one's going to notice.
Yeah.
And so that's who David attracted. And then Wayne kind of got all the rest. And you can kind of see, it's almost like David clocked Wayne as one of those kids.
Yeah.
And doesn't mean he's wrong.
No. And I think that that on top of Dean sort of providing the drugs, the alcohol, the location, all everything that he would need to for Wayne to fall further into this, he happily delivered on a silver platter because it meant he was bringing other boys and victims with him. And I don't know, it's worth a watch. But again, I don't feel like there's really anything crazy new about it. You do get to hear from him and see some people, but
you get to see some of the parents of some of the victims who are so elderly.
Oh, I know.
And it's like their kids should now also be elderly, and it's terrible. But I say I take it with a grain of salt just because Wayne has had like 50 years to carve out his statements.
Yeah.
To probably sound as remorseful and as likable as he can because he has something to gain.
He does. I also, the part of me that wants to be an optimist feels like even if he feels this way, even if this is the truth, I'm sure there's a percentage that's exaggerated for the viewer and the parole board. But I'd like to hope he feels remorseful the way that it comes across. It doesn't mean I think that he should be let out. But if you want something that would give you information that you didn't have before, let me turn you on to some shit, because there's a docuseries called The Clown and the Candyman. I watched it on Apple TV. I'm sure you can watch it anywhere, but this is really what dives into that connection potentially between Gacy and Coral, and it is fascinating. It's making an itch in my brain. I got a scratch, you know?
All right, well then let's get into this. So we'll move away from the interview with Wayne. If you want to watch it, let us know what you think.
Yeah.
There is this very strong belief that there is a greater network at play here, mm-hmm. right? One that far surpassed Dean Coral and John Wayne Gacy and others like them. On August 15th, 1973, Dallas police uncovered a large network of sex trafficking where young boys and men were being trafficked.
Mm-hmm.
They found records of at least 10,000 victim names in a card filing system.
Thousands? Cards. Can yep. we just take those two words?
Mm-hmm.
Wild.
Like they had like a Rolodex yep. of victims. Some of these victims were linked directly to Dean. Like these were known victims of his.
Yes.
That ended up in this in Dallas. The rest though, we don't know.
Right.
You know, fast forward 2 years to the spring of 1975, Houston police performed a sting operation that yielded 5 arrests, all for possessing child pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see child pornography listed as CSAM, so C-S-A-M, child sexual abuse materials.
Yeah.
So 11 of the boys pictured in the CSAM were victims of Dean's, all of whom were deceased.
Yeah.
So pictures of them when they were alive and being tortured. And that's interesting, but also photos aren't something that we see referenced in a lot of sources.
Right.
I didn't read anything about Wayne or David claiming Dean photographed his attacks, yet there are photos. So maybe they weren't present for that. Maybe there's other victims that he was taking more pictures of, and there's just a few of the ones that we know are linked to him. Maybe it lent credibility to Dean's initial claim that he was selling the boys into sex trafficking, like yeah. he was photographing these things and making money, and that a buyer was secured and then they were sold, and then again maybe he accidentally killed somebody and then that's what kind of started this killing. Or maybe dead people can't rat on you, so maybe that's why he decided to kill them. We don't know.
Right.
But it is also possible that Dean was doing this before he used David as an accomplice. I think that can show, okay, there's other things that these boys did not know.
Right. And I think it's interesting because a lot of the times when you think about serial killers who take photographs of their victim, it's for their own personal gratification, to sort of like reminisce on, to look back on.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem like that was the motivation here.
No, he probably made money off of those.
Right. And I wonder if it was any combination of actually selling these poor victims into trafficking, or even just selling the photos of yeah. the pornography to the market that wanted them. But it's very interesting because this is all not even mentioning that a producer of child pornography, Roy Ames, was connected with this ring, and his name was found on a card in Dean's wallet.
Yeah. So, big red flag.
Child pornography producer on a little business card in Dean's wallet. But another name seemingly connected Gacy and Coral, and that is John David Norman. That documentary that I just talked about, The Clown and the Candyman, reviews this connection that John David Norman might have provided. Having been convicted numerous times himself of child pornography and molestation, John David Norman was a known player in this ring, like this specific one. Ugh. And he had various, hear me out, direct mail newsletters, like a pamphlet that comes to your door. It's like a zine, but it's freaking disgusting child sex trafficking and child pornography. And he sends these collections to anyone in his own ring. And now the connection here is that he lived in a lot of places, but he did confirmed live in both Texas and Illinois, where Coral and Gacy were respectively living during the times they would have had contact with him. Like he was there around the same times as them.
Uh-oh.
And further, while in Texas, the mailings in the pornography ring John Norman ran was called the Odyssey. And this was out of Dallas, Texas, which is exactly where Dean said this prostitution was being run out of when he told David and Wayne.
So maybe there's threads of truth there.
Right. And this connecting piece to Gacy also is, I mean, just as tenuous. Like, this is a potential connection, but it's not surefire. You know what I mean? The other connecting piece to Gacy, though, is that Norman's closest associate worked for Gacy.
Okay.
And that none of these show explicit evidence, but they create a lot of circumstantial evidence that paints quite the picture. I heavily recommend the docuseries if you're interested. Again, I watched it on Apple TV. I'm sure you can find it in other places, but it's like literally 3 hours. It's so good. And by good, I mean horrifying. You might have nightmares. But it is a fascinating connection that I don't feel like is really explored, given how interesting this link could have been.
Yeah, I mean, I think more people know about John Wayne Gacy than know about Dean Coral. But you would think that the two would be kind of synonymous, given the times that they were operating and these, like, seemingly reliable links between the two, that even if they didn't know each other, they knew common people.
Right. Well, and they might not have known each other directly, but even Gacy directly talks about Coral, like, in interviews. He's like, yeah, he had, what, 27 victims? Like, I have 33. Which is crazy to know off the top of your head, and crazy to know about this man.
Yeah.
Around the same time in Texas, who has, you know, on LinkedIn, secondhand connections, you know? Like, that is insane to me. And there's just no talk of it other than this.
Yeah, Dean would have showed as, like, someone you may know.
Right, literally.
Ugh.
Dean is that horrifying person that pops up on your Facebook suggested friends that you're like, no, I know them. I don't want to be friends with
them,
but I know them.
There's a reason I haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
Do not show me this again.
Exactly. But as we've said before, it is hard to do a series like this justice and give you all of the information on victims that they deserve when there are just so many. This case is so big, and genuinely, we struggled to keep it to 4 parts.
Oh, I know.
Give enough information and stay sane through it, but we cannot and we will not end a series as horrendous as this without bringing it back to the victims. Dean Coral's victim count is insurmountable. And from the victims he murdered to their friends, family, neighborhood, and those who loved them, those who they loved, and those who would never get the chance to know them, and those left to live in fear from the actions of all of this, there's just no way to know the sheer amount of torment he's had on this world. It's possible he even inspired and is partially then to blame for the 33 victims of John Wayne Gacy. The ripple effect of those murders as well. And it just goes on. But we want to take some time here at the end of this piece just to honor the boys and young men that we lost to this monster that are known. Jeffrey Allen Conan, 18. James Eugene Glass, 14. Danny Michael Yates, 14. Donald Wayne Waldrop, 15. Jerry Lynn Waldrop, 13. Randall Lee Harvey, 15. David William Hillegeist, 13. Gregory Mallywinkle, 16. Donald John Falcon, 17. Frank Anthony Aguirre, 18. Mark Stephen Scott, 17. Johnny Ray DeLome, 16. Billie Jean Balch, Jr., 17. Stephen Kent Sickman, 17. Roy Eugene Buntman, 17. Wally J. Simoneau, 14. Richard Edward Hembury, 13. Willard Carmen Branch, Jr., 18. Richard Allen Kepner, 19. Joseph Allen Lyles, 17. William Ray Lawrence, 15. Raymond Stanley Blackburn, 20. Homer Louis Garcia, 15. John Manning Sellers, 17. Michael Anthony Balch, 15. Marty Ray Jones, 18. Charles Carey Cobble, 17. James Stanton Dremala, 13. Timothy Curley, 20. Rhonda Williams, 15. And unknown victim, aka John Houston Doe or Swimsuit Boy, unknown. And that is what we have for you on this case for Dean Corll. And we are wrapping this series up
with a bow on top and kicking it
out the fucking door.
Because that's where Dean belongs.
Mm-hmm.
We have worked countless hours on the series for you. We have like 40 pages of research. Yeah. We have pages of sources that we consulted for this episode. We'd love to know what you think. Needless to say, we worked very hard on this, and your feedback means the world to us. Did you like it? If you didn't, why?
Yeah.
You know, email us, leave us a message down below, send us an Instagram message.
We'd love it.
You know how to reach us. We will again be taking a brief break, and we will return on Halloween.
We will see you then.
But in the meantime, we have nearly 200 episodes for you to listen to in our catalog here. I will say we get better with age, so we'll go back to the very first episode.
Feel free to compliment us on how far we've come.
Proceed with caution. But we also will be ever present on Instagram and hanging out with you guys, posting.
Yeah, that's also where you can see the people, the places, the things.
The pod pets. If you haven't sent it, you should.
Please, dear God, tell us what you think of Wayne's weird ass art. Full offense. And let us know your thoughts. We are interested. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear anything you got for us. And just because we're taking a few days doesn't mean you won't see us soon.
Of course. So,
in the meantime, if I do check my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye, guys. See you soon.